This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wage World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like living in Wage World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available this show on these websites and at www.affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wage World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Jonathan Carmel, who wrote an interesting book called, well, not an interesting, an important and tragic and sad book called Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace. Jonathan's a labor lawyer, I think based in Chicago, is that right? Welcome to Wage World, Jonathan.
Thanks, Wade. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure because this is, as you mentioned over and over in the book, this is a subject that doesn't get as much attention as it should. Isn't that correct?
I think it's one of the most underreported stories in our country, and it needs to be told.
You've been a labor lawyer for a good number of years, but one of the points you make is that in some ways, the level of workplace injuries caught up on you as well.
Yeah, I've been doing union-side labor law, representing labor unions around the Midwest and Illinois and Chicago for over 35 years. And when I started becoming interested in the subject, I was, frankly, a little bit embarrassed about how much I didn't know about workplace injuries and the problems that workers face every day going to work and hoping they come back home, alive or in the same condition that they left. And it's really the numbers were stunning to me. And that's why I decided to write the book and tell stories, because I feel that in order for people to become really engaged and aware about the problem, it has to be more than just statistics. It has to be stories about the workers and their families.
The statistics are horrifying. I mean, just a quote from your introduction, in 2015, the last year with complete data, Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that 4,836 workers were killed on the job, or 13 workers every day. You know, that's just stunning, isn't it?
That is. And those are the reported numbers.
And exactly.
Both with workplace deaths and workplace injuries, the numbers are underreported for a lot of reasons. And the most current numbers since I wrote the book, they've spiked up just a little bit, but it's still around 14 workers who are reportedly killed every day on the job. 150 workers die every day related to workplace illnesses and exposures, and around 5,000 are dying, are getting killed every year on the job.
And you make the point that if you compare this to some of the other situations where we spend billions, it's like people aren't noticing that folks are dying every day trying to make a living, compared to some of the things we see as security threats and other kinds of, you know, airplane crashes or whatever. I mean, none of that compares in terms of fatalities to these workplace deaths, does it?
It doesn't, and there's a lot of lip services, we all know, given to workers by our politicians, frankly, on both sides of the aisle, to workers and the great American workers. But when it comes to really protecting them and resourcing government agencies to protect them and make them safer and healthier at work, it's really a shameful situation.
we've sort of stumbled into this unreporting problem. So when we talk about this number of injuries, I mean, you have a whole section in which you look at how badly the reporting is. And this is partly because for businesses, these deaths are just the cost of doing what they do, aren't they?
It is. And if you don't have a lot of inspection, you don't have a lot of enforcement, and frankly, you don't have a lot of regulated workplaces and a regulated work hazards, employers don't have a lot of incentive to really do much in the way of keeping their workers safe and healthy in the workplace. And I'm not, you know, I don't condemn employers or every employer in this country, but they just don't, it's not a high priority in many workplaces.
Yet you see, you know, one truck after another for utility companies and oil rigs and whatever, safety first, and how many days
right.
without an injury, and it just doesn't seem to add up into hard and fast policy, does it?
It doesn't. And you mentioned I think you put a number there, 180 days or something without an injury. We've all walked past
right.
construction sites where they'll have signs posted, X amount of days without an injury. And frankly, I write a little bit about that in terms of what causes underreporting. And that's one of the things that causes underreporting. It sounds like a great kind of thing to put out there for workers to see, but no worker wants to be that worker who breaks that streak of 180 days.
Especially if there's a bonus that comes with it.
Especially if there's a bonus. And sometimes it's not even a bonus. It might be as simple as a pizza party or some other recognition. So there's a lot of peer pressure in those kinds of situations that look like fairly benign or positive ways to encourage workplace safety. They're actually ways to discourage workers from reporting.
Let's talk about some of the stories for a second, and then we'll get into some of what we need to do about this. But I particularly looked at, I live in New Orleans. We've organized Hyatt Hotel Workers. It was the first election that our union ever won, so I was particularly drawn to that. You know, in 1980, when we organized Hyatt Workers, they were doing 16 rooms a day, and reading the story, I was very struck by the story you told of the Hyatt worker in your book. Why don't you relate some of that?
I'll back up just a bit. And one of the I tell the story of a hotel housekeeper, and she was a Hyatt hotel housekeeper, but her problems occur in many of the major hotel chains. But one of the reasons I told a story of a hotel housekeeper, as well as other workers in industries that we don't normally associate with workplace injuries, is because exactly that we're unaware of. We think it's all coal miners or offshore oil workers who are the ones who are getting injured, or construction workers, but it is somebody that we come into contact with frequently, including hotel housekeepers. And Angela Martinez worked at the Hyatt Hotel in Chicago, large property of theirs. And she was assigned to clean upwards, between 15 and 30 rooms a day. And her job is to, like most housekeepers, to change the beds and clean the bathrooms and dust it and clean up the mess from the guests. And that's a really grueling, grueling job. I mean, think about lifting or making 15 to 30 beds a day.
Well, and I think one of the points that you underlined that, struck me from, these decades in which I've organized hotel workers is the job, the quota on rooms may be staying the same, but the job has gotten harder because of the weight of mattresses, the duvets or whatever they call them, the number of pillows. I mean, I've been into hotels, where all of a sudden you're moving six or seven pillows before you even get to lay down to, take a nap. It's crazy.
And one of the sources of the injuries in work in hotels for the housekeepers is the bed sheets.
Right.
They're not fitted. And it sounds like, why aren't they fitted? Most of us all have, your listeners, we all have fitted sheets, and we just kind of like throw the sheet on there and kind of snap in the corners. And these workers, they don't have fitted sheets. And Hyatt at the time wasn't providing them with fitted sheets, so they have to lift these heavy, heavy mattresses, tuck the sheets in the under the corners and the sides and the front and the back, and that's grueling hard work. And they all begin their day by the water fountain, by the time clock, taking Advil or Tylenol or other pain relievers just to get through the day. And another...
And they used to have housemen, you know, who helped with that. But that,
right.
that's largely, I know there were housemen in the unit when we organized the Hyatt in New Orleans, but that's, I'm not sure those even exist anymore in many hotels.
And there's another workplace hazard that these housekeepers have that I didn't write about because it's now sort of just coming out since I wrote the book, and that's assaults on housekeepers from their guests. When they knock on the door and they go in and clean the room, many housekeepers, women, women of color, and some of them don't, you know, are new to this country, they're getting sexually assaulted.
Well, and of course, there was the famous case with the World Bank executive from France in New York. And
that's right.
Many stories have come out about, you know, and this was always part of what we used to hear in the organizing, people that would expose themselves or, you know, say, come on in, and they, you know, would be coming out of the shower. And, you know, this is just part of the job in terms of how management sees this.
Right. And unfortunately, until recently, until this campaign is now kicked off about reporting these assaults, many of these, mostly women, wouldn't report these assaults. So again, that's part of the underreporting going on.
Well, people are afraid for their jobs. I mean,
yeah.
You can be fired for almost anything. We're talking to Jonathan Carbell, who's an attorney based in Chicago, who's done a deep dive in recent years into the problem of occupational health and safety. Let's talk about oil and gas workers. That was another one I looked at specifically. You know, I did that work for a couple of summers coming out of high school, and it helped me get into organizing, frankly. But that's dangerous work, isn't it? I mean, I was struck that you said it's many times more dangerous in some cases than work that we associate with real peril, like mining and other incidents.
It's very dangerous work, and notwithstanding the fact that it's a fairly regulated industry, OSHA has identified many workplace hazards that are supposed to be regulated, and it's still a very dangerous work. I mean, where you now reside in New Orleans and running across the Gulf, it's all much of that's all oil work, and the workers there are very aware of the dangers that they risk every day going to work. And the story I tell of Ray Gonzalez, who is an oil worker at a refinery in Texas, and he wasn't out on the platforms. He was an operator, so he was maintaining a lot of the equipment in the refinery, and he
normally you'd think that would be a safer job.
Right, except when you're not following
exactly
protocols, and in this case, the protocols weren't followed, not by Ray and his coworkers, but by management and the supervisors, and Ray and a coworker of his were scalded literally to death by a pipe that had burst that they were trying to repair, and water, boiling hot water, poured down on them and just seared off their skin.
I was aroused about in both the Oklahoma fields, and then the next summer I worked offshore on a platform. And, you know, in Oklahoma we had 21 straight days over 100. It gets dry. And, you know, if there was a brush fire somewhere near a drilling pad, or a well pad, whose job do you think it was to fight that fire? They'd give us some water tanks you put on your back, and we were firefighters.
Right.
Can you? I was 19 years old, 18 years old, I guess 18 at that point. I'm almost, you know, that's a crazy story to tell. Nobody, I mean, who could believe? I mean, we didn't have training. We went out there and squirted water until it went out and hoped we could stop the fire. When I worked offshore, one of the jobs was, I'll tell you, to get on the platform, a crew boat takes you out, okay? And it comes every day or whatever, but when you're coming in on changing shifts, and I was working just as a contract employee on a Chevron rig, so I worked 14 on, 7 off. And I had the paperwork and ice, you know, with me coming in. And, but you know, there were swells in the water, but you were supposed to swing from the platform onto the boat on a rope. And I swung out with the stuff under my arm, and a wave pulled the boat one direction, and I went the other direction and right into water. Well, you had these little life jackets, okay, but, and I could swim. So the stories, but once again, this is crazy. What risk that were, you know, mundane. We would have to paint the top of the tanks as roustabouts. And it's slippery. You didn't have any harness. I mean, now I see people with harnesses and everything else. Thank God. But we were up there. The wind was blowing. And, you know, you're slippery and sliding around there. And I, you know, look, I was 19 years old then. It certainly occurred to me that, was this how I wanted to die? I mean, but this is routine for workers. I mean, and you mentioned risk premium. Tell people what that is.
Well, the risk premium is a fantasy story being pushed by the anti-regulatory right-wing think tanks that are funded by groups including the Koch brothers, and they come out of reputable, you know, ostensibly reputable organizations and universities like George Mason. And so one of the fantasies they...
I think George Mason is a subsidiary of the Koch brothers now, isn't
it? It might be,
yeah. Go ahead.
That's where the Scalia Law School is.
Exactly. They've gotten, you know, tens of millions of dollars from the Koch family. Go ahead.
So these anti-regulatory fabulous make the argument that we don't need regulation because the marketplace will take care of workers and keep them safe by what they call the risk premium. And what they say is that when a worker goes in to get a job and they won't take a job that's a dangerous job, or they'll demand a higher wage to work at this more dangerous job, and so employers will either clean up their act and make it more safe so they can attract workers at lower costs, and therefore that's how it'll work. The marketplace will take care of that. But it's a fantasy because, as we all know and your listeners all know, when you go in for a job, whether you're a 19-year-old or you're a 40-year-old, and you're applying for a job and you're interviewing for a job, you don't ask the interviewer or the HR person, give me all your data on your safety, the safety at your company, because I want to evaluate that before I take your job offer.
Well,
that doesn't
and furthermore,
happen.
What bargaining power does an individual worker have trying to get a job, your probation for the... You know, what are you supposed to say? Oh, well, I know this is an oil field job. I want an extra $5 an hour because
that's what
my life is work is $10,000. If I work there a year, that's a $5 premium for every hour.
Exactly. That's the fantasy that they push, is that once the worker gets that information, they'll say, well, in order for me to work here, I now want $10 more than you're offering me because it's a very dangerous job. And it's nonsense. First of all, they don't have the information. Second of all, they don't have the bargaining power because the HR person, the minute you ask for the information, they'll say, thank you very much, we don't need you.
Or they'll tell you another, you know, there's a line as long as the, you know, corridor waiting to take this job. Sorry, Sam.
So it's a complete fantasy and it's a complete lie, but that's what they push. We don't need regulation.
I was struck. I mean, I've bargained a lot of contracts, Jonathan, and I've never heard anybody talk about a risk premium. And so when I saw that, it just sort of jumped out of the page. Why? You know?
Well, because you bargain them in union settings where no employer would dare talk about that.
Although they may believe it. They all believe it, I think.
They may believe it.
That was like a, you know, you learn something every day in this work. And I thought, you know, reading through your book last night, that was one of the things I learned. We're talking to Jonathan Kermel, who's written a book that's just come out in paper book. It's from Cornell University called Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace. Jonathan, I know you spend a lot of time in the book talking about how we need to fix some of this. OSHA is underfunded. The chance in this administration has got to be, you know, abysmally low to really hope that we can get much changed in the law. But talk truth to power here. What really needs to be done?
Well, there isn't a silver bullet. I wish there was, but there isn't. One of the things that I hope to accomplish from the book, if people read it and hear about it, is that they become aware of the problem. Because this isn't something that just doesn't happen to somebody else. Everybody works. And it's just not oil platform workers or coal miners who get hurt or even hotel housekeepers. It's grocery store workers who I write about who get killed on the job. It's all sorts. It's everybody who works. Knows somebody, if it's not themselves, who works. The degree of separation is zero. Everybody is at risk or a loved one is at risk. So people need to become aware that this is a problem. This is a problem for all workers, and we should demand that our politicians start protecting us. So putting that aside, that's one thing we can do is demand protection and regulations and from our politicians. We also need to reform OSHA, make it really a law that protects workers, and it doesn't. The penalties for someone getting killed on the job and an employer who violates a regulation that caused the death of this worker, on average, is about $5,000 for
which
a worker's
puts a
death.
Life to the risk premium. At that low a compensation for something as serious as death on the job, Why would any employer give you a dime?
That's right. So it doesn't even cover the cost of a funeral. And so that needs to be, and the money, by the way, if and when they pay it, doesn't go to the family. It goes to the U.S. Treasury. So OSHA needs to be given some real heft and some teeth in enforcement, which it does not have right now. The other thing we need to do is, and this is really important, is when workers get injured, we need to make the workers' compensation system across this country manageable for these workers and to deliver what it was promised to deliver when it was created, and that is when you get hurt on the job, you're going to get your wage losses paid for and you'll get your medical benefits paid, and you'll get, if you're disabled, you'll get disability benefits.
And now, I thought in the book that was an area you made a number of points about workmen's compensation that really did seem like it might, if we really pushed hard enough at some of the state levels, it's insurance. We ought to be able to change that regardless of what's happening in Washington.
Right. Well, I talk about we need a universal or a nationwide and workers' compensation system. Right now we have a state-by-state-by-state, 50-state workers' compensation system that is controlled by the insurance companies, the private insurance companies. So when a worker gets injured on the job, instead of getting that benefit by just submitting a claim and say, I was hurt on the job and injured on the job, and here are my medical bills, you have to go through this litigious insurance fight with the insurance company who doesn't want to pay these benefits out.
And often based on company doctors or doctors recommended, where you're sent to doctors that are close to the company, even if they don't work exactly on the payroll.
The whole system is broken. Yeah. And it's broken for workers at a time when they need assistance and help the most, when they have no income coming in, when they are hurt and suffering. They have to go and go through this incredibly difficult system to get any benefits whatsoever. So that needs to be fixed.
And a lot of workers aren't covered by workman's compensation either.
Some aren't. That's right. And again, workers who are the most vulnerable and are working at some of the most dangerous jobs and the hazardous jobs are workers who are not covered by them. And who are those? They may be a 19-year-old like you that you may not be even reported. You may be working off the books and getting cash because you're a 19-year-old, and what do you know? You're happy to get the cash. But when you get injured, the employer will say, who's Wade? Wade, I don't have anybody named Wade on my on my books.
Well, and in my case, I was, a contract worker for something called Oilfield Maintenance and Supply, which is a contractor for Chevron. And in the other case, I was part of, something construction company on contract to what was then Skelly Oil. So, who was I to them? Chevron, they would have had, several layers of denial and a team of lawyers, as big as you've seen to say, no, we don't know who this kid was.
And it happens to workers, undocumented workers. And I don't want to debate the immigration crisis we've got right now and immigration policy, but the fact remains we've got millions of workers in this country working for us, working to put food on our table and to build our houses and our streets, and they're not, many of them aren't covered by workers' compensation or other parts of the benefit system.
And they're in dangerous jobs.
We're
broadcasting from Arkansas, and, the first time this happened many, many years ago, Tyson's Food was one of the big, promoters of a different immigration plant. Well, of course, they had huge numbers of undocumented workers because who you think works at a chicken plucking plant, in Arkansas or wherever, is a lot of Latinos and others. And that's, if it's a dangerous job, if it's an agricultural job, that's where we have a lot of immigrant workers and undocumented workers. And what recourse do they have to say, there's a problem, it's a safety issue on my job?
None. Because there's another one who will take their job.
Exactly. We're Debbie Downers on this today. Well, what's the best hope you see?
The best hope I see, and I write about it, is that we really have to, kind of forget about Washington and trying to legislate, meaningful health and safety laws in Washington or reform OSHA, because Washington is so broken and dysfunctional. And as Tip O'Neill famously said, all politics are local. So we've got to work locally and demand that our local politicians enact laws and ordinances that protect workers. And that's occurring around the country, whether it's the fight for $15 wages or responsible contractor ordinances, which I write about in the book, that many cities around the country are enacting, which basically says that if a business wants to contract with a public entity, whether it's a city or a county or a state, and receive taxpayer money to build a project, they have to affirm and certify that they are a good employer, meaning that they don't discriminate against their employees, and they provide safe workplaces, and they don't have a bad safety record or health risk record, and that they provide good wages and benefits. And if you want public money, you've got to be a good employer. So those are things that are occurring. And frankly, there are local criminal prosecutions that are going on around the country, where local prosecutors are criminally prosecuting employers, their supervisors, their owners, for worker deaths and injuries.
Certainly there was the Blankenship case and mining.
Well, there's a Blankenship case. That's a famous one. But there was, there were prosecutors in Los Angeles County were prosecuted a construction company where a worker was suffocated to death when the trench he was working in, trenches that you work in, are supposed to be supported, so they don't cave in, and it wasn't, and this worker died, and the owner was criminally prosecuted.
No, that's Don Blank. Bad Don news, Blank, good news there, and three.
Yeah,
when you pointed out that a cubic foot of dirt is weighs 3,000 pounds, or I can't remember. I'm like, whoa! Look, how do people get your book, Dying to Work?
Well, the book is on all the major book websites, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it on Cornell University Press's website. And it's now in paperback. It's in Kindle. I think it's an important book. As I said, I think it's an underreported story.
And as Attorney Carmel said, we want people to read this book because we need a lot more pressure on reform for workers. This has been Wage World for another work week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wage World. Thank you.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, a grassroots effort to produce public radio news and information serving the needs of low and moderate income working Americans by providing a platform for voices not commonly heard in mainstream media. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.